This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. At the turn of the last century, the predominant theory about Native Americans was that something had to be done to turn Indians from savages into good, God-fearing, contributing citizens. Thus sprang up across the country what came to be known as Indian schools, places where children of various Native tribes found themselves being taken, sometimes by force, from their parents. The most famous or infamous of these institutions was the Carlisle Indian School. Writer Chris Gavala has taken the lives of two Carlisle students and built a novel around their story, using fiction, he says, because it was the best way to tell the truth about what he calls the absurdity of racism. Gavala's new novel is called School for Tricksters, and it will be our focus right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Question: how did you come to believe what you believe about race? Perhaps like many Americans, you were exposed as a child to preconceptions about people based on their ethnicity, and you accepted those prejudices simply because the adults around you told you that was what was true. Then, as an adult yourself, you found yourself trying to unravel those old prejudices because you determined they were not, in fact, valid. Or perhaps you find yourself even today still challenged by prejudice. Stanton-based author Chris Gavala says he wrote his newest book in part to challenge ideas about race and racism. It is an historical novel based on the true story of two children who almost 100 years ago tricked their way into the Carlisle School for Indians and became classmates of the young man who would become the Carlisle School's most famous graduate, hero athlete Jim Thorpe. There's much more to the story to explore this hour, but if you find that you have questions or comments along the way or thoughts to share in general about the nature of prejudice, you are welcome to join us at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or to post a question or comment to us on Facebook. Here in the Insight studio with me, author of the new novel, School for Tricksters, Chris Gavala. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Chris, if you could, I was hoping that please you would start with telling us a little bit about what Indian schools were.
Absolutely.
Both in general and the Carlisle School in particular. And then tell us about how you came to write this book.
Many people don't know much about the Indian school system in the United States. It was one of the reasons I was drawn to this subject matter. Colonel Pratt is the person who founded the Carlisle Indian School, and it was the first Indian school that was off of reservations. The idea, they put it in the middle of Pennsylvania, as far away from Oklahoma and the western reservations as possible, with the idea of isolating Indian children, taking them literally and sometimes abducting them, taking them away from their families, taking them away from their homes, their tribes, and placing them in the middle of Pennsylvania in an all-white environment so that they can be re-educated, that they can be indoctrinated into what was considered white American values. So that school system started at Carlisle, and I'm looking at the school really 30, almost 40 years after it had been founded.
This was a school system that was run by the U.S. government, the Carlisle being the first of what would eventually be several of these Indian schools.
Exactly. This was the model school.
And they started, well, Carlisle started sometime in the 1870s.
Correct.
And your story begins about 1912.
Correct. So the school has really changed a great deal. When these schools began, I mean, the original students were literally prisoners of war. But by 1912, a lot of the lines have become blurred. You've got students who have gone through the school system and have come out and become staff members. So whereas originally you would have all Indian students and all Indian, rather all white teachers, now some of those lines are blurring. So things have become complicated. You've got some students who are still there unwillingly, but you have some who have taken great effort in order to get into the school. So because it's an opportunity in some cases for a free education. And many of the students who were there have really, one of the most horrible things about the school, have accepted the indoctrination and see themselves as needing to become as white as possible. So there's now internal racism between students And so this period in 1912 was much more complicated than the earlier school from the 1870s.
And part of what I guess we have to realize is almost 100 years ago, when your novel begins back in 1912, free public education was a rarity anywhere in America. Parochial education, Catholic school education had started in many places around the country in the late 1800s after the Civil War. But the fact that getting a good education was difficult, especially if you were poor, is part of what underpins the story of the two characters in The School for Tricksters.
Exactly. One of the main two characters, her name is Ivy Miller. Now, understand that these characters are real. I'm taking the historical record, I'm working from biographical facts, and I'm weaving a story from that, but essentially everything that happens in the novel could have happened. So you have Ivy Miller, who, as a child, her mother dies and her father abandons Ivy and her siblings at an orphanage. And her opportunities are, of course, wildly limited. Because of, and now this is very strange, I went into the Carlisle records trying to figure out exactly what happened, but at some point it seems that the owner of the orphanage saw an opportunity to get rid of a bunch of kids. And he declared that Ivy and several other students were Indians, were Shawnees.
In fact, they were all white.
As far as we can tell. I've looked at Ivy's family tree, and there's not much evidence to suggest that there was any Indian blood there. There's always some possibility. So she becomes Shawnee overnight. And then later, that allows her to enter into the another Indian school. And it's interesting to look at the records because when she left the orphanage, she was a Shawnee. The next morning, she was a Cherokee. She probably because she wanted to be with a friend who was Cherokee or something like that. It's very odd to sort of try to piece it together. But what she's doing is finding an opportunity to get a free education. And she this is her way of sort of getting out from the orphanage. The second character, Sylvester Long, is also entering into Carlisle for the purposes of not just an education, but for him, he's escaping from the South. He is a mixed-blood character from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He's culturally black. He has a great deal of white blood, a great deal of Indian blood, it would appear. It's very difficult to know for sure. Now, he had very few opportunities in North Carolina. For him, passing as Indian, at least Indian as the government is defining them in 1912, is his way out of Jim Crow South. So for him, he's not only looking for an education, he's looking for a way to escape being controlled by being called black.
Now, as I understand it, he comes from a family in a rural area outside of Winston-Salem that thought of itself as black, but much of the family was light-skinned. They move into Winston-Salem proper, far enough away from their original home, and they pass themselves off as white.
That's correct.
And at the time that Sylvester comes into that family, I guess the family's already moved to Winston-Salem?
Yes.
And then eventually somebody comes from the original county where the family used to live and calls them out as actually being black, and they can't live as whites anymore.
Exactly. They were both born as slaves. I think his mother was a slave for literally 1 year, and then the Civil War ended.
Exactly. Sylvester's parents.
Yes. And so they lived as whites for a time period because particularly Sylvester's mother is very, very light-skinned. And Sylvester is rather light-skinned, too. Many of his siblings could have, simply by moving out of North Carolina, passed for white. Sylvester, by appearance, looked a little more Indian. And in fact, when he grew frustrated with living in North Carolina, he joined a traveling circus and played a wild Indian for several years. And that was his first act of performing race, performing Indianness for a white audience. And apparently he was very good at it and saw this was an opportunity he could keep exploiting and keep making things happen for himself. That, you know, he watched his older brothers stay in Salem and stay black, if you will, and being controlled by that. And it was very clear that he was unwilling to live that life. And so he found a very, very inventive way out.
Stanton, Virginia-based writer Chris Gavaller is our guest. His newest novel is titled School for Tricksters. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And Chris, right in the first few paragraphs of your novel, right at the opening, when you're talking about what the reader will eventually find out is Sylvester's trip up to the Carlisle School to enroll there at the age of 18. Just these first few paragraphs really hint at the kind of amazing story to come, and I wonder if you could just read those for us.
Absolutely. This opening passage of Sylvester is on a train, and this is his first time that he's moving from the South up to Pennsylvania, the first time he's been out of the South and stops being black. This chapter is called Sylvester Becomes an Indian. The rest of the passengers are dozing, lulled by the rattle and drone of the tracks. Sylvester sits upright. He's watching the landscape shift behind his reflection. Outside, the Mason-Dixon is an invisible fissure sutured by rail lines. He watches until the blackness slows, then trembles, and then hangs in his window, motionless, except for the engine's hum. The train pauses as he counts seconds, a full minute, 2 minutes, three, before he stands, grips his sack, and slips out to the platform, just as the rear car is churning forward again, before the conductor can correct him, call to him, Carlisle, another 40 miles yet. He changes at the border, in an alley facing the one building depot in State Line, Pennsylvania. It's barely a town. A few clapboards slouch two-dimensionally in the half-light, with a wall of flattened hilltops circling them. A quarter moon hangs above the buzz of the platform lamp. It's midnight. Sylvester folds his best cotton shirt into a square on the edge of a shopkeeper's rear stoop and steps away, smelling of strangers. His mother salvaged the cast-offs from the Baptist church basement from a box-marked furnace. The trousers, a restitched flour sack, chafe where the reversed letters curve into the seam. The left and less ragged hem reaches mid-calf. Sylvester hopes it will make him seem taller, give him that extra inch he has never stopped believing he will grow into. The chambray shirt exposes a gash of dark flesh between the missing buttons. His fingers press at it. He is 18. He is done growing.
Chris Cavaller reading from his new novel, The School for Tricksters. And a few pages later, we meet the other main character, Ivy, who you were describing to us a few moments ago, Chris. Sylvester and Ivy were not your original intent.
No, they were
for
not.
Main characters of this book. Tell me about how you came to write the book and how it came to be about two people that you hadn't originally intended it to be about.
My original focus was on Jim Thorpe, who is easily the most famous person from Carlisle, regarded probably the most famous athlete of the 20th century, certainly
and
the first
half.
And
yet it's possible there are a few people who aren't familiar with Jim Thorpe.
Jim Thorpe won the greatest medals in 1912, was considered the greatest all-around athlete, and he went on to have an amazing football career as well as baseball. He was there's actually a brand new biography about him right now from Kate Buford. So I was intrigued that Thorpe was at the school, and as he's there, his teacher, his typing teacher, is Marion Moore, who's not as well known, but is a very significant modernist poet. It seemed like such a strange pairing, this poet and this athlete, and they were both 25. She was a teacher and he was a student, but he, Pop Warner, his coach, had a way of bending as many rules, breaking as many football rules as possible. So
that's something else that most people are going to be surprised to learn when they read your book, is that Pop Warner football,
yes,
owes its name to the person who basically ran the Carlisle School, at least at the point in history
exactly.
When your book takes place. He was, would it be fair to say, a rule-bending football coach?
That would be a perfect description of him. Many of the rules that we take for granted about football were invented because he was cheating.
So that the rules came to be so that you couldn't do what Pop Warner used to do
exactly.
In football, including in a high school, having a 25-year-old play for you as your star player. There's much more about Jim Thorpe, about Ivy, about Sylvester, and about the point that you're trying to get to, Chris Cavaller, in this book. So we will get to that pretty quickly when we return from this break.
Too bad no one invited Sylvester, not properly. He was a handsome boy, and so smart, too. She'd heard he was an orphan, like Jim and her. She almost wished she had asked him, though imagine what her sister would say. Grace had trouble enough stomaching Indians. Imagine if Ivy had said yes to Gus. He only liked her because he knew. Everyone did. She was the prettiest girl in the school, he said. Everything was mixed, thought Ivy. Everybody. None of this had cost her anything. The government paid for it. Ivy never chose this home, this self. Not exactly. She only chose not to resist it. And now it would fall away from her just as completely, without her having ever understood it, having ever felt it was hers. It was only the government she fooled, white people, like her. They thought in blood quanta, in tribal rules, mathematics and geometry, lines that converged or did not. Next year, after she was gone, then she would be a white girl who had pretended to be something else once. But she was not that yet. She was still just a girl, a pretty girl, in an Indian school. Julia was shouting at one of the new girls, the first year. She had strung the streamers the wrong way. Julia wanted tighter loops. Ignorant, said Julia. You're so ignorant. Ivy didn't turn to watch. She kept scrubbing and squinting. The day was bright through the windows. It shone everywhere, every streak of filth. This was an ugly room, but it could be made beautiful. With the sun gone and the music loud, Ivy might pretend it was beautiful.
The novel is titled School for Tricksters. Its author, Chris Gavaller, is our guest. And Chris, I ask you to read those final few paragraphs that end the book, because there's so much that sums up everything that we've gone through once we make it through the entire novel, even in timing. Most of the novel is chronological from the time that these two students are early in their education at the Carlisle Indian School and things that happen to them at the Carlisle School and then things that happen to them soon after they graduate and then much later in their lives. And you do bring in Jim Thorpe, who ends up being the husband of Ivy for a good period of time. But then at the very end, you go back to this setting that's significant in many ways. In terms of storyline, tell us about the setting that you have Ivy in there as you are revealing her last thoughts at the end of your novel.
Ivy is preparing for the social, the school dance where she's going to dance for the first time with Jim, who she's had a huge crush on and has clearly wanted to date, and this is her big opportunity.
So after going through much of her life in this book, we are now back to the time when she's about 17?
Correct. I would like to explain my artistic choice for doing that, but I have to admit it's more intuitive than not. The first half of the novel is set in Carlisle, and we watch Ivy and Sylvester live their lives as students. And in the second half, we watch their lives sort of spread out over decades. And in this final chapter, I felt the need to return to the school. And in fact, it's the only chapter where Ivy and Sylvester directly interact. And it felt to me like they're such an odd pair. They're both, you know, the two students who are passing, who are pretending, and they belong together.
One who is white pretending to be Indian and one who is mostly black pretending to be Indian.
Exactly. And so this chapter is where we finally see the two of them interact face to face, but it's just a brief encounter. They didn't really find each other. In a way, I feel like they're perfect mates for each other, but it never quite happens. So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So in this chapter, Ivy has a quick thought about Sylvester, but then her thoughts move to Jim, who's the person she's really in love with and who she ends up with, at least for a period of her life. Their marriage ends in divorce, and she ends up not only leaving Jim, but leaving Indianness. She steps back into white culture, and this just becomes something that was in her past. She's able to step away from Carlisle completely. And that's something that Sylvester is not able to do. I believe because, well, being black, to step back into this role, you know, go back to North Carolina would have been stepping back into deep prejudice. And so once he entered the game, he could not leave it.
The last four sentences that end your book, Chris Gavaller, The School for Tricksters, I'd like to read out loud again. The day was bright through the windows. It shone everywhere, every streak of filth. This was an ugly room, but it could be made beautiful. With the sun gone and the music loud, Ivy might pretend it was beautiful. We're going to talk more, I'm sure, about the different ways that you examine the racism that these youngsters face. But it seemed to me that, one, you were ending on an upbeat note, and two, you were expressing some hope other than just what Ivy was thinking about whether that room could look better.
Carlisle was an ugly place. There's absolutely no way around that. But good things could still happen there, and good things did happen for Ivy and Jim and Sylvester. And I agree, I was sort of trying to move to a sort of a more positive moment, even though chronologically, to do this, so I had to step backwards in time to this moment where there's still hope for Ivy, where there's still hope for all of the characters. Sylvester's life ends tragically with suicide when he's finally fully exposed. Rather than step back into his old life, he prefers to end it completely. Ivy's life ends not as tragically, but, you know, she has a stroke and she spends the last few years of her life more or less in a waking coma, paralyzed, rather horrific ending. But this moment of hope that I move back to at the very end of the novel, it's not quite redemptive, but it does show the possibility of people escaping from these false definitions of race. Or at least that's what I was hoping to evoke.
Chris, I've heard you say before that one of the reasons you wrote this book and one of the reasons you wrote it in the manner that you did was because you were hoping to draw attention to what you called the absurdity and the destructiveness of race. Tell me about that.
Well, that defines the Carlisle Indian School. That defines the entire Indian government school system. It was designed to define and destroy Indians. The fact that in this country at this time period, you know, an Indian could be minutely defined as anyone with 1/8 ancestry. An African American was anyone with one drop of African blood, which is
based on a Supreme Court ruling.
Exactly. These are absurd definitions. Scientific. This is not science. This is pseudoscience. These are ideas made up in order to promote the idea of white supremacy.
But the U.S. government at the turn of the last century held these ideas to be scientific.
Exactly. But they are not now. I mean, you can talk about, when people talk about race, they're talking about ethnicity and they're talking about culture. But to say that people of different ethnicities are fundamentally different is just false. There's no scientific evidence for that. And so what I'm trying to say, one of the things I'm trying to say in a novel is bring out how, you know, the Carlisle School, it shows what happens when these rules of race are applied as deeply as possible, not just on the surface of these children, but it cuts into their selves, it cuts into their identities, and that's where it's most corrosive.
To you who are listening, when you were a child, what did your parents and other grown-ups teach you about race? Do you remember how you reacted the first time you encountered someone of a different race or ethnicity? How do those feelings and beliefs you had as a youngster differ from what you feel and believe today? Our phone number is 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can reach us on Facebook either by clicking on the link at WMRA.org. Or if you're already on Facebook, just search for us under the name Virginia Insight. Chris Gavaller, author of the new novel School for Tricksters, is our guest. Tell me about your experience with race and how it came to a point where in your career as a novelist you decided to write a book that is so centered on drawing attention to these concepts.
I was inspired by Toni Morrison. She has a book from early 90s called Playing in the Dark, where she analyzes a lot of white American authors like Hemingway and shows how, even though they're not intending to, they're creating ideas about race accidentally, you know, unconsciously. And that really intrigued me deeply. Usually, if you read anything that refers to race in the United States, it means you're talking about blacks, maybe Indians, but not whites. It's as though whites is a different category entirely, somehow removed from race, bizarrely, which, of course, makes no sense. So I was interested, because of reading Morrison, a lot of my writing tries to explore ideas about racial difference.
And I'm curious about that question. I guess the same that I was just asking the audience. Do you have a memory of what you learned about race as a small child?
Absolutely. One of my strongest memories as a child, the side of our house, one year, I was probably about six, someone painted the word Niger lovers. They misspelled the word. They didn't know that it has two G's. Niger lovers was against the side of our house because my parents were very involved in the civil rights movement. My parents, with some friends...
Where was this?
This is a suburb of Pittsburgh called Penn Hills.
And this is what time frame?
Around 1970. And they, with a few friends, created an organization that very successfully was able to take the Penn Hills Police Department and force it to integrate, which was just a huge fact. There were the Penn Hills Police Department at that time would not allow anyone black onto its force. There were black state troopers, you know, and of course, being a state trooper is much more difficult than just being, you know, local police officer. State troopers were unable to pass the test that blacks were given to get on the Penn Hills Police Department. So my parents were involved, very involved with the civil rights movement, and I, in having Niger lovers spray painted across the house, I guess was a significant event in my childhood as far as framing my ideas about race.
You may be like some friends that not only do I admire, Chris, but I really kind of envy. But I don't know quite how to ask. I'm going to have to tell you what those friends tell me and see if it resonates for you.
Okay.
And they are people who tell me, I grew up in a family where my mom and dad always said, there are good people and there are bad people, and what they look like doesn't make any difference. What their last name sounds like, what their skin color is, where they come from.
That describes my parents well. I mean, it sounds, I know they're listening, so this is a wonderful compliment to them, but it's absolutely true. So that was just a given fact of the universe to me as a kid that, you know, regardless of, you know, I had no choice but to absorb that wonderful message, and it just became a part of, you know, who I am.
I hope that there are many other people who had that experience. Mine, I think, was quite different. Growing up in the Northeast, I can remember as a very small child when my grandfather's farm was still being worked, that the migrant workers there and my family thought that they were being polite when they would refer to them as those coloreds.
Right, right.
I remember an instance. It's still vivid in my mind. I must have been all of 6 years old when we were at a major department store in downtown Rochester and standing in front of an elevator. And my stepmother was a fairly new character in my life. She'd only been around for about a year at that point in time. And just as the elevator doors opened, some people walked up. And, of course, we are white. They were black. They waited for us to go into the elevator. And my stepmother said, oh, no, you go. We have to wait for the next one.
Mm.
So they went. And after the elevator doors closed, I remember looking up at her and saying, Why did we have to wait for the next one? And she said, because colored people smell funny.
Wow. What year?
1960s?
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems to me that I grew up with lots of people who today still have a significant problem looking at people who are of other race and seeing the person first as opposed to seeing the race first.
That's exactly what I'm trying to get with. The point I'm trying to get at with this novel, there are many chapters where you've met Ivy and you know that she's really white playing Indian. And so there are several chapters where the point of view is from someone who does not know that. So a white 12-year-old, for instance, looks at Ivy and can't see her. He sees all of these romanticized ideas of what Indians are like. There's chapters where Sylvester, who is, you know, very aggressively playing the Western Plains Indian, where a white narrator will look at him and only see, superimpose over him, his assumptions about race. This is precisely what our society is like still today in the 21st century. We can't directly look at each other. There's so many layers of false assumptions placed between us.
The new book at the center of our discussion today is a novel. Its author says part of what he hopes the book will accomplish is to get people thinking differently about race and racism. Since this novel has just been published, it specifically cannot yet have had much impact on you, but I'm curious if you listening can think of another work of fiction that did have a marked effect on your view of the world and of people around you. We'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, find us listed as Virginia Insight. As you researched this book and you looked at all of the historical documents, that many of which were government-sponsored,
yes,
that delineated different things about different people's race and assumptions associated based on what their race was listed as. Did you see anything that caused you to see this whole issue of prejudice and racism differently, Chris Cavaller?
I remember being intrigued by the fact that the government concluded, and for reasons that it seems absolutely arbitrary, that if you are 1/8 Indian, you're still Indian. But after 1/8, you cease to be an Indian. Of course, they invented this concept so that they had a clear line to say who can go to an Indian school and who cannot. But any attempt to draw a line differentiating people, wherever you place it, it's absurd. And so just seeing an example of, okay, they've drawn the line here, and then just studying it very closely just shows the ridiculousness of it and the destructiveness of it. So I was intrigued at specifically how the government at that moment in our American history was defining, quote-unquote, Indians.
Were there things about assumptions based on race? I mean, even good assumptions? Certainly this school was founded in part because of the assumption that people who were born into Native American families needed help escaping from savage-ism and that they were less intelligent to begin with. But Jim Thorpe, I would imagine, was seen as a story about how somebody with warrior blood could become a great athlete. Certainly, even today, certainly in my childhood at least, there were people who were talking about blacks having a special gift for being entertainers or good singers or good dancers. Did you run across any of that sort of reverse prejudice that assumed good things about people based on their race, which in itself is sort of a denigration?
Well, one of the horrific things is how the government would play black against Indians so that students, you know, the Indian students would be told, well, you're better than Negroes. And so with the idea that Indians could be trained in a way that blacks could not.
School for Tricksters is the title of the novel. Chris Cavaller is its author. Christian in Winchester, you will be our first call up when we get back from the break. Then I think we've got Ron from Charlottesville, and we've still got a couple of lines open at 1-888-WMRA-TALK. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. We'll be back in just a bit more than 60 seconds. Chris Cavaller's new historical novel is titled School for Tricksters, about the Carlisle Indian School near the turn of the last century. The school's best-known graduate was athlete Jim Thorpe, but he plays a fairly minor role in Cavaller's book, which focuses primarily on two other children who also attended Carlisle. In Winchester, Christian, thank you for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Chris Cavaller, please.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say that I truly appreciate the book, just hearing about it. I haven't obviously had an opportunity to read it yet. But for me, I come from mixed ancestry. I come from a family who's very mixed with black, white, Native American.
Okay, so you're very much like Sylvester Long.
Very much so. I mean, most of my family, the Dogons from the city of Alexandria, could pass for white. And I married to my wife is a full-blood Native American. She's mm-hmm. Tonawanda, Seneca, and Odawa.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people look at my children, and they look at me, and they have very curly hair, brown skin, and they look at my children kind of like, well, who's this guy? Because my children both look like they're, you know, full-blood Native Americans, even though they're only three-quarters. But one thing I made a comment on for us and how we look at it as is, even though race is so important just because it culturally identifies who we are,
yes,
it should only be about the person. And I think Carlisle and people who look into more history of the Carlisle Indian School and study about it can definitely realize that what they did from the beginning, you know, really didn't help culturally.
No.
People, because you have people today who are ashamed to be Native American.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who are of mixed ancestry who don't know, you know, their history about that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's what you're speaking about is exactly the hope I have for this novel, is that it's, though it's a historical novel set over 100 years ago, it's really speaking to issues that are important right now. There are so many mixed race people in the United States. In fact, that's sort of almost the definition of the melting pot. And so that is our, really our national identity. And we still tend to think in such rigidly counterintuitive categories of race, which is just not helpful. It's destructive.
Absolutely.
Christian, before you go, tell me a little bit more, if you would, about, I think this was the wording you used, race is important because it culturally identifies who we are?
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, I say that in meanings of, for me, you know, being multicultural, I've had several people come up to me and they'll ask me, oh, well, what are you? You know, my typical answer to that is a human being, but at the same time, my wife and I are very interested in foreign culture. And so when I legitimately walk up to someone who's from Southeast Asia, but I can't identify which country, mm-hmm. I actually want to know, because it's something different and it's something else about the world that I can appreciate. And that's when I think that race can culturally identify us. If you walk into my home, not only do I have Native American art, colonial art, I also have African art. And it culturally identifies our household and who we are.
I think you and Sylvester Long would have a great deal in common. I think if Sylvester were alive today, and as opposed to 100 years ago, he would have had more options that were closed off to him far more severely back then. So I would, I of course know nothing about you, but I have to believe that your life is much better living now than if you had lived 100 years ago.
Yes, absolutely.
Christian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
To you also listening, can you identify with the concept of struggling against prejudice? 888-WMRA Talk is our phone number. That's 888-967-2825. On Facebook, we are listed as Virginia Insight. Next to Charlottesville, Ron, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment for novelist Chris Gavaller, please.
Well, first of all, I just want to commend him for that subject. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is my favorite. I'm a very, very busy guy. I love to read, but usually I don't have time to read additional other things. But I plan to get this one.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
That's a real compliment.
Yeah, I don't live too far from the bookstore here. I will definitely pick it up. My experience is different from the last one. I grew up in the Caribbean, Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And people describe me wrongly. All they see is the black skin.
right.
Really, culturally, the way I grew up, I can identify my wife is black. And I usually tell her, really, if you want to understand my culture, really, it's all white. I'm a coconut, I guess. So I'm not ashamed to tell people to describe myself as a coconut because I didn't force. That's my culture. You know, that's the culture I grew up with in the 80s and in Haiti when it used to be a little bit more decent place.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Did you move to the U.S., if I can ask?
Oh, yeah. My mother was worried about my future. I really had no plan. I was 20 years old in school, and she was worried about my future, and she told me, get out of here, and get out with a visa and came here, and now I'm an American here.
So what year was this when you were 20?
81, the U.S. is here.
So in the early 1980s, when you were 20 years old, you came to the U.S., and
right.
You saw people reacting to your skin color much different than you ever had before?
Well, Well, no. Actually, my experience, I'm watching both sides, you know, black, white, you know, white, you put me in the category of black, and black think I'm black. Actually, my culture is white. They think I'm trying to be white. So actually, I now I'm very frustrated with many of my black friends because really many of them are racist. They don't even know it.
It's interesting you say that they don't know it because I think that describes the vast majority of people.
Yes. And like you said, one thing you said I love, you know, people, when they bump into people, what they see is just the color, skin color.
Right.
So usually I make it easy for everybody. I say, well, do you want to know my culture? Actually, I'm really black French.
There you go. So it's interesting.
Cool,
so you're a perfect example of someone that looking at you really tells you nothing about you. Yes, you can see your skin color, but that says really nothing about your culture.
Nothing. So I think, like you said, I believe the greatest mistake the human race ever made is really to come up with the classification of race.
Yes.
I'm so sick of it. I really believe it's the greatest mistake they ever made. And I can't believe how we can have so many smart people in the world to make that mistake. Here we are in the 21st century. It's still going on strongly. I can't believe it.
The mistake was made intentionally. It was made by white people in power for the purposes of staying in power. And now it's taking centuries and decades still. I believe that things will change, but we have got this leftover concept of race that does not belong to the 21st century that we've all grown up with and our parents have grown up with and our grandparents have grown up with, and it's going to take decades more for it to slowly fade out. But I believe we're moving in that direction, at least I'm an optimist.
Yeah, if I may say one more thing, sorry to catch you up there, I wanted to say that, and one of my greatest frustration is that, you see, I guess because many black people are less educated, or maybe because of their experience, I see them hung up even in a greater number in that subject in that area. They just can't let go. Now I understand the experience is not mine. I did not have that same experience with white. I understand that. It's so hard for them, so difficult for them. In my opinion, I will tell you that they have a greater problem. I think many of the white, they never associate with black. I understand that. But the blacks, even when they are around white, many of them are racist, so I'm concerned.
Certainly.
Ron, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
No, I'm sorry. I embarrassed myself there.
Not at all. Thank you.
School for Tricksters is Chris Gavaller's second novel, but the first one based on historical fact. He has also published numerous short stories and a number of plays, and he serves as visiting assistant professor of English at Washington and Lee University. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. We've only got a couple of more minutes for calls or Facebook postings. Phone number 1-888-WMRA-TALK, 1-888-967-2825. If you're already on Facebook, you can find us just by typing in Virginia Insight, where it says search there. Or if you don't have a Facebook account, you can still get to a posting on Facebook by going to WMRA.org and looking for the little tiny blue icon up at the top of the WMRA homepage that says join us on Facebook. Here is, I'm sorry, I think I'm going to mispronounce your name, but it looks like it's Anton or Aiton. Aiton says, I find this conversation fascinating. The notion of becoming white by losing one's own identity has been interesting for me as an immigrant from India. I often wonder how my children will react to being asked, where are you from? They were born in Virginia, but of course, all some people will see is a brown skin. Does Chris have a sense of how his book might relate to the immigrant experience?
It's interesting because the immigrant experience is very similar and overlaps with all the issues that we've been talking about in terms of race. You know, I'm 50% Slovak, which is a rather not a particularly well-known ethnic background. But every immigration group that's come to the United States over various decades has faced extreme prejudices. The Irish, Italians, it's a long list. And to realize that those experiences are essentially the same experiences that Indians and African Americans are experiencing throughout history of the United States and currently. That, in fact, these things should be things that are drawing people together as shared experiences. That there's not antagonism between whites and blacks, but in fact, there is far more shared experience. I'm speaking, of course, specifically of immigration groups that have had to deal with tremendous prejudices.
You use what seems to me, Chris, an unusual structure in how you tell this basically true tale.
Yes.
Except for the fact that much of what we are experiencing in reading this novel, School for Tricksters, is the thoughts of the different characters in the story. And since I'm guessing that you didn't go to a channeler and speak to the real Sylvester and Ivy in The Great Beyond, that you had to guess at their thoughts. But there's an awful lot of internal dialogue, both for the main characters and the minor characters.
Mm-hmm.
Is that?
I found that essential. I mean, I could have written this as a nonfiction book and just presented Ivy and Sylvester together, showing their two lives working in parallel. And that would be a good book, but it wasn't the book I wanted to write because I didn't feel that that went deeply enough. I feel that as a fiction writer, I have the opportunity to go and actually imagine into these people. Now, of course, my Sylvester and my Ivy, they're not ultimately the people who actually lived. I've created these characters based on their external facts. But I think that's an absolutely essential act because it allows readers into the experience more fully. I mean, our lives are not simply a list of verifiable facts. And that's ultimately, a biographer is sort of limited to that kind of approach and occasionally can gesture into what a person might have been thinking or feeling. But as a novelist, I could enter very deeply into that internal world, and all the external facts are the tools that allow me to do that.
Chris, we talked early on in the hour about whites not seeing themselves as a race and some of the comments that you'd read of Toni Morrison's about the absurdities that people have in their heads about racial prejudice. And I mentioned that I suspect there are lots of other people who had experiences like me early on where we basically were instructed by our elders to see things through racial filters. And certainly in terms of impact of media, of the television of the 1950s and 1960s, where different races were generally portrayed pretty much as certain stereotypes.
Absolutely.
And it is only, I am somewhat ashamed to admit this, but I wouldn't be surprised if other people can identify with this. It's only been probably within the past 10 years that I've begun to notice that when some of my favorite novelists will not mention anything about a character whose skin is white, but they may well say a large black man walked into the room.
Exactly.
Because so I wonder if this, if your sense is in all kinds of subtle ways, even today, we are being taught that white is normal and something other than white is abnormal.
Right. If it's the default mode. So I know exactly the kind of moment you're talking about in writing where if you describe someone walking in a room, if you don't mention their race, the reader, of course, I'm just sort of doing it now myself, but more often than not, the assumption is that that person's white, which is absurd. So many of the things I'm trying to get at with this novel is to bring forward everyone's race, or rather everyone's externally defined race, so you can see that these categories are bizarre and ultimately meaningless. I keep trying to switch point of view, so one chapter, you've met Ivy and you know her background, but in the next chapter you're seeing her from someone else's view. With Sylvester, at one point, he's pretending to be a Western Plain Indian who can be a fantastic tracker, and he's being looked at by a white middle-aged man, and the guy can't really see who's actually he's dealing with. He can't see past the false layers.
We're just about out of time. Before we go, I really want to see if we can get you to talk about your wildest dream for this book. I mean, if this was to become as successful as, I don't know, Moby Dick or
no, that's an interesting choice.
It seems to me that most any famous books I can think of are going to have some racial tinges in them that I don't mean. But
what would you hope if large numbers of people read this book, that the impact it would have would be what?
I would hope the impact would be to start, or rather continue, a national conversation about race. I know that sounds cliched, but it's what I would hope, that it would allow people to give them another angle of looking at race, just another small tool so that they can sort of understand that what race in the United States is a broken concept, and it would be just one more way of sort of pushing it to the graveyard where it belongs.
Perhaps that all of us more often would look at our reactions and see if there's a long-held racial or...
There always is. There always is. Doesn't matter how hard you work at it, that's always going to be there. So you have to just keep digging and revealing to yourself the assumptions that you've been given, that you didn't create, that they've been sort of accidentally forced on you, and so you can find them and let them go.
Our guest has been Chris Gavaller, author of the historical novel School for Tricksters, as well as a visiting assistant professor of English at Washington and Lee University. Chris, thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.